the most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. We are here to present Orson Welles' commentaries. I think we have three left. I don't know, something like that. Anyway, this one is a really interesting one that goes into directions that I immediately got lost, and I'm sure you will as well. At least some of you may not. And so Vincent and Terry are here to help us navigate through this and figure out what he's talking about. He's certainly passionate about this one, and I enjoy that he came back to this and didn't just soft pedal. I thought after the last episode, which focused on Moby Dick, that he might just finish off with doing Bible readings and so forth. But no, he's going to go out with a bang on politics and shoot into that again. So Vincent, why don't you take us into what this one is kind of about for the folks?
Yeah, so as Buck mentioned, this episode is a whirlwind of confusion unless you're up to date with both Truman's foreign politics and the politics of Henry Wallace. I hope to piggyback off of what Terry is going to say about Henry Wallace. So I will start with something else. Two things that came to mention. One is at the beginning, Wells, he knows at this point that his show's getting canceled, and he starts sort of reflecting on the work that he's done this entire time. And in the next couple episodes, that'll become even more clear. Like, he'll try to summarize, like, if nothing else has come out of these broadcasts, here's what I hope. But he's starting to do a little bit of this work now. And that actually involves a recapitulation and, in fact, a reimagining of some of his politics, which were he's reframing in sort of a false way. So I'll give you the example. At the beginning, he starts by talking about the United Nations and Russia and the problems of essentially dealing with Russia and the United Nations and the clear sense that Russia is a threat to world peace, for example. But Wells paints it as this clear picture from the beginning. And I will say, if you go back to the commentaries we made earlier in 1946, for example, he's actually, I wouldn't say pro-Russia, but he's very optimistic about Russia. He paints his portrait of Russia is not out for war. They're kind of preparing if there is a war, but they want peace like everybody else. He paints them in an optimistic way, and not because he's a communist, but he does have certain sympathies and affinities for, I wouldn't say communism, but socialism, certainly. And he wants world peace. And he knows that to do that most effectively, you're going to need Russia behind you. But in this, he paints a rather dismal picture, essentially, of the United Nations as well, which he also, in those early episodes, is like really hopeful. And he's trying to convince people, hey, you need to be behind, he calls it what, UNO.
Yeah, I love it that in this one, because we talked about it at the time when it came up, that we'd never heard of anybody call it UNO before. And he mentions in this one, oh, I used to call it UNO, or we used to call it UNO. And so it's already lost that within the first 6 months or something of his existence. It's like, okay, we won't call it that anymore. So I like
but he
too. Yeah.
But he continues to call Woodard Woodward. So who knows, you know, about that. But yeah, he also says, like, oh, it was clear at the beginning that the UN was breaking at the seams, that things weren't going to go well. And so I think he's sort of rewriting his own history of this short-lived broadcast in that sense. And so we shouldn't just take his word on it. That's what he was thinking the entire time, because he's sort of saying, like, oh, all reporters knew this. I don't think that's true. The other thing that I'm going to mention is an anecdote, but I think it's particularly interesting. I was so shocked when he started talking about, I believe this is this episode. Yes, the cane. And I was shocked that he mentioned this cane, because I've seen this cane and I've touched this cane. And the cane still exists. It's at the University of Michigan Special Collections Research Center. The story I was told, We got it from Orson Welles's daughter. And the story we were told when we acquired it was that FDR gave this to Welles as a gift for helping him campaign. That story doesn't seem true now. It seems adjacent to the truth. But, you know, it is very decadent. I will say that the actual cane, the head of it, the one that I've seen, is ivory and not silver. So either they're different canes, but I don't think so, because Welles specifically says, like, I don't know why he gave this to me. I'm not like, I'm not polished or gaudy. I can't remember the exact word he uses, enough for canes. So he didn't like just have a bunch of canes. It wasn't like something people gave him regularly. But it's very ornate, very beautiful. And it does seem to come from Africa or the Middle East or something, just by the designs of it. So I believe this is this cane. I have held this cane. It is very like diplomatic, powerful. And so I learned a little something about the just history of this cane from this broadcast, a thing that I never thought he would have ever brought up. But it did paint this picture of how close Henry Wallace and Orson Welles were. And that's the one story I do want to end with, which is in 1944, Welles campaigned with Wallace. He was, as a progressive liberal, Welles was really behind Wallace in a way that he was not behind Harry Truman, and was disappointed, obviously, when FDR swapped him out for vice president. But at one point, Welles was campaigning so hard for Henry Wallace, he gave this, Welles introduced him at Madison Square Garden before a speech. And they seemed so in sync, the story goes, according to one of Orson Welles's biographers, that the crowd started to chant, it was something like Wallace and Welles 1948, Wallace and Welles 1948. So that should indicate how close they were, but also how politically, simpatico they were, even though Welles does disagree with Wallace in various ways over the next couple episodes.
Interesting, Vincent. And that's really cool that you actually got a chance to hold that cane and everything. That is neat. What a neat tie-in that.
Yeah, I'll find some pictures of it.
Wow. Awesome. Awesome. Kathy, what did anything stand out in this episode for you, other than it was confusing as all get out to me? But
it's packed.
Yes.
Packed with a man who can think a million things at once and wants to get it all out, maybe because he knows now time is short. But as we've spoken of a number of times, it amazes me the detail to talk about what tumultuous times this was politically, culturally, socially. It's so easy to think, the way I might teach freshmen or high school students to say, World War II ended and everybody was, going to Disney World and so happy and so relieved. And then how do you explain the Cold War starting so soon? But here in this granular detail that we've had, just as Vincent, you said, to see him go from so hopeful to so despairing so quickly. They said it's one thing to read it in books, another to hear somebody going through this time when you're just sure war could, atomic war could be starting again any day, that you're exhausted from the war, but suddenly hear all these other huge issues and conflicts that come up. I find it very interesting that Welles, and I'm sure Terry, you're going to tell us more about it, that Welles and Wallace are both saying, we don't necessarily want to do what the British want us to do, because indeed we ended up doing a lot more of what the British wanted us to do respect Russia's rights or feelings in this traumatic post-war era. But as I said, I'm just to hear all this conflict, all this fear, just amazes me. And as I said, makes me want to teach a seminar called like 1945, 1946, with this as one of the basic textbooks and having to unpack it every week. Fascinating.
For sure. Well, and I think, and I've said this before about Orson, but it would be so interesting to hear what Orson would have to say today. I think at the time, he would have been completely surprised and delighted with the fact that we haven't had a nuclear war between multiple countries since this time. I mean, it just seemed like oh my gosh, this is what's going to happen here. If it doesn't happen in 5 years, it's going to happen in 10 or 20 years or something. Well, now we're 75 years on and it still hasn't happened, and knock on wood, hopefully it never does. But it is, if anything, again, the whole fact that we talk about this echoing, I feel like we're probably unfortunately closer to a nuclear problem than we've been in years and years and years, because so many folks have it, and with Iran probably getting it soon and so forth. Then anyway, and the Korea situation and all that. So anyway, let's go over to Terry and get his thoughts on this whole thing. So go ahead.
I want to give you all a little background on Henry Wallace, and it's Henry A. Wallace, not to be confused with his father, Henry C. Wallace, who was also in politics. Henry A. Wallace had been FDR's vice president prior to Harry Truman. And we're talking about Democratic Party politics. The Democratic Party, as Will Rogers, the great American humorist, famously said, I'm not a member of any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. They have a long storied history of, shall we call it, variety.
Yes.
And in the 19th century, they were infamously pro-slavery, and then evolved into this more left of center party with factions within the Democratic Party. And even to this day, we see a huge split between what is more or less a centrist party and a rather dramatically left-wing party, or as Wells and Wallace called it, even in 1946, the progressive wing. And there was, in fact, a progressive party that wanted to nominate Henry Wallace to run for president in 1948. The centrists in the Democratic Party at this time pushed Roosevelt to replace Wallace with a more conservative, as they saw it, vice president, that being Harry Truman. And so even though after FDR died and Truman became president, even though Wallace was no longer in one of the highest positions, Truman did keep him on as Secretary of Commerce, and later he became Secretary of Agriculture, I believe. And he did play an important role. And his role as Secretary of Agriculture was important because he had been a farmer, and he'd also been a journalist, and he had great respect. I think he's from Iowa, and had great respect for a Midwest constituency. So this was not a fringe guy by any means. He was within part of the mainstream of American politics, given that the Democratic Party was and continues to be fractious.
Well, he was very close to becoming president, as you say. I mean, had they not switched it, interesting bit on alternate history would be, what if he hadn't switched to Truman and Wallace became the president, and how would that have changed things?
And so there's speculation about how American foreign policy might have evolved. There might not have been the conflict that we saw, you know, the Cold War.
Yeah.
Might not have been as dramatic. Then again, you know, a lot of people in Central and Eastern Europe might have found themselves more firmly embedded in the Soviet sphere of influence. So, you know, I love speculative history.
Yeah. But
these questions can never be answered because Henry Wallace did not become president.
Well, and then it becomes, would he be a continuation of the FDR movement, right, and have served, two terms, and we wouldn't have Eisenhower as president, or would Eisenhower have been president a little later, and we wouldn't have got JFK as president? I don't know. It's just interesting how that could have all played out. I'd love to read a book on that. But anyway, go ahead, Terry.
Well, the only other thing I want to say about this commentary is that Wells, we remember Orson Welles. he and Wallace were not just close friends, but they were almost of a mind when it came to their views, as you all have pointed out, on the American Soviet relations. And whether or not things would have evolved differently under a Wallace presidency, both Wallace and Welles represented a sizable segment of the American population that wanted less conflict. Don't forget, we had just gone through the Second World War and not long after the First World War, and Americans were tired of international conflict. So I think one reason Welles found a receptive audience for his commentaries, not universally, of course, but that he had a lot of loyal listeners, was because he was representing this idea that we should stop fighting with each other in the world, that we need to find common ground in the world. And I think that's really at the heart of this commentary, as we will hear in a moment.
Well, and would if Wallace had become the president, would we have Welles as his vice president? Would we have even been involved in Korea? Would we have just let that work itself out on its own and had us not involved? I don't know.
I would not discount so easily the not repressed anger of conservatives who had gotten all the way through. I mean, I think there'd still be a tremendous amount of pushback. And maybe even more.
Because it would have been
wonderful, but look at how hard conservatives are trying to in a way just sort of politically use hatred of Russia to try and stop and limit, punish Rooseveltian Democrats.
He might have gone down even easier and faster than Truman did. I mean, he very well, history could have done the exact same thing, but he would have just been seen as, oh my gosh, he's way too liberal, and everybody freaked out, and who knows? But that's alternate history, so who knows? But here is Orson with his commentary, bringing us his views on history as it was in the making, so kind of cool. We'll see you folks next time. Thanks, everybody. And just to clarify, when I was hearing about Henry Wallace, I was thinking, is this the Mel Gibson character from William Wallace that he played in the film, Braveheart? But no, I was informed by Terry that I was wrong with my research on that. And I also had to throw out my research that he was on Time Magazine as Mike Wallace, but that was incorrect as well. So I think they were all related, though. I think they're all brothers or something, but that's my version of history, and I'm sticking to it. So we'll see you all next time. Enjoy.
Hello Americans, this is Orson Welles broadcasting. Glad to be back with you again this week. Well, I flew in from San Francisco the other night, and the talk on the plane on that beautiful moonlit night among my friends and neighbors, sitting there with their seat belts on, waiting to land in San Francisco, was all of war and the threat of war. A lot of the folks I know here on the West Coast and on the East Coast, people who write me, people I talk to, and people I overhear in public places, are concerned with war clouds and the proximity of atom warfare. I think the Wallace speech, the Wallace letter, and the Wallace resignation have brought into sharp focus many of the problems relevant to this. But really nothing new has happened, nothing we couldn't have guessed. I remember that even in the first weeks, it was clear to most of us who covered that first conference in San Francisco, the free world, whose armies and factories and soldiers and peoples had beaten down the enemies of peace, that free world was splitting in two. That free world wasn't one world anymore. The victorious partnership of powers called the United Nations was dividing and conquering itself. Most of us, correspondents of the newspapers of the world assigned to observe and report upon that hopeful gathering of the diplomats of the world, I remember, made early comment on the split widening between the East and the West. There were grave differences of outlook between us correspondents. There were differences between our publishers, even more sizable and serious. But on the main outline of our subject, that first conference, we shared unhappy agreement. We might be wiring our news stories to Pravda of Moscow or the Clarion Sentinel and Dispatch of East Updich, Illinois, wherever we sent our copy and whatever our separate attitudes and special instructions. We all knew, and most of us were saying, that UN, we called it UNO in those days, was coming apart at the seams. Last year's war unity was gone with last winter's snows. Even as the United Nations Charter was being hammered into words, its principles were dissolving in words. Russia was too suspicious, even then in San Francisco. The cynicism of her spokesman tainted the sweet air. Oh, yes, the air in those early eager days hadn't been soured with international abusiveness, smudged up with legalistic bickering, befouled with broken promises. Russia, of course, felt isolated in a capitalist world society. I remember the men with their portfolios under their arms walking the streets of San Francisco as though they were not only in foreign country, but in enemy country. And when we saw the copies of the Chicago Tribune being flown into them by airmail, flown into all the delegates, we began to understand how they felt and why they felt that way, but Russia came out of the war a great victor and a great victory, a huge new power among the nations, the hearty appetite for growth. Britain was facing the first shock of its lowered and lowering prestige. The U.S. had just awakened to the news that it was the strongest and richest country in the records of civilization. It was San Francisco a year ago, but at this breathless moment of realizing our wealth, we who were Americans had to face an impoverishment very terrible indeed. Franklin Roosevelt was suddenly gone. And we were the partisans of the people's cause, we who were enlisted on his side of the battle everywhere, from the Andes to the Alps, looked into the blank smile of a little man from Missouri, a very decent but a very little politician, with all the virtues and all the vision of Main Street. Mr. Harry Truman, for a number of none too good or sufficient reasons, had inherited the biggest job in the whole history of the human race. You know, I heard him admit one day, not long before he became president, that he, Mr. Truman, didn't know a thing about foreign policy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain of the mightiest state in the mightiest of grand alliances. In one checkered year, he has committed, in his easygoing way, I think more than one politician's quota of cheerful blunders. The latest we might call Operation Wallace. A lot of excitement still raging about Operation Wallace, but the smoke's beginning to clear. We can begin to make a little sense about it. The best sense, of course, is contained in what Henry Wallace himself said. I want one thing clearly understood. That's what he said. I am neither anti-British nor pro-British, neither anti-Russian nor pro-Russian. And just 2 days ago, when President Truman read these words, he said they represented the policy of his administration. Unquote. Henry Wallace is a great man. He's a very good man. That much we can be certain of. And I think the greatness is beginning to show through, even when the political wisdom wears a little thin. Whether progressives like it or not, he is their accredited spokesman. I respect him for everything he has accomplished, for his huge integrity, and for his great courage, however mistaken it may have been at this moment. I'm also very fond of him as a friend. I'd like to tell you a little story about Henry Wallace, my friend. Oh, not so very long ago, somebody, a sailor from South Africa, gave Mr. Wallace a large cane with an excessively large silver knob. A flashy and flamboyant article of furniture, to be sure, and I saw Mr. Wallace walking along rather ruefully on his way to the train, holding it, as though it didn't belong at all to him, but glad to have the present. And I was seeing him off on the station. I'd just gone to get him a paper, and he said, "Here, Orson, you take the cane." I said, "I can't accept anything as nice as that. It's very valuable." He said, "All right, I won't give it to you. I'll loan it to you." I think the assumption was that I am sufficiently flashy and flamboyant to carry such a thing as that cane. I think that's why Mr. Wallace gave it to me. Anyway, it's a treasured possession. I'm afraid that he complimented me in thinking that I had sufficient style to walk around with a cane about the size of two fists, but I'd like to try it someday. There's a condition that went with the loan. He said, you can have this cane on loan from me for as long as you do good deeds. Every year you report, and if you don't figure you're doing good deeds, then you give me back the cane. Nice little ceremony, and I appreciated it, and I've reported a couple of times now. Tonight, or maybe tomorrow, I'm getting on a plane flying to Providence to take Henry Wallace's place at the meeting in Providence, which was to mark the occasion of his second speech on this question of foreign policy. I may take exception to Mr. Burns as well, or to rather, I may take exception to Mr. Wallace on a few points. In the main, however, I will be an understudy, and a very poor one, I'm sure the audience will find, but I'm going because I have a great deal to say on my own, and I would like to explain on the air first so that the sponsors will have time to notify me that I don't need to come, that there are certain points where I will not follow the what might be described as the pure Wallace line. I don't know what the Wallace line is. I think I know what he believes in. I've also studied this recent and apparently very atomic speech. Incidentally, the letter which caused all the trouble, I think I can tell you now, I have it on very reliable authority from Washington, that the leak to Drew Pearson, who printed the letter, you know, and who was denounced by Henry Wallace for having filched it, which Drew Pearson denies. The letter was leaked to Drew Pearson by the State Department in order to force a break between Wallace and Truman. It's a fairly important revelation which I'm making on this subject, but as I said before, my authority is pretty good. Well, you know, from my dough, the sad thing about all this resignation business and weakening of Burns's hands in Paris and general misery is not so much that the vaunted bipartisan unity has been destroyed or impaired. I'm not even saddened by this fresh instance of Mr. Truman's political incompetence. No, I'm sorry to see the world in such a state of helter-skelter retreat that the Wallace speech can seem like appeasement to one half of the electorate and like a definitive restatement of the Roosevelt international morality to the other. The Wallace speech in question and the Wallace letter, which is an extension of the same, is neither. It is neither the Roosevelt international morality nor appeasement of Russia. Henry Wallace doesn't want to appease the Russians. He just wants to drop... He just doesn't want to drop bombs on them. He wants to avoid bomb dropping in general. But Henry Wallace says what's happening in Eastern Europe is no business of ours. And what's going on in Bulgaria and Romania is none of our business any more than what's happening in South America is any of Russia's business. And it's just here, and here only, that I would take exception to any of Henry Wallace's points, because for my dough, ladies and gentlemen, what's going on in Eastern Europe is very much our business, and what's going on in South America is Russia's business, that what's happening everywhere is everybody's business. In a word, I'll say this. Getting tough with Russia won't stop a war. Getting soft with Russia won't stop a war. You may say, is there no way then of stopping a war? Yes, there is, by building a free world where wars can't happen because they just plain don't make sense. Well, how do you build a free world? The answer is easy, but the job is hard. You build a free world the way our pioneer fathers built a fort, by clearing a place in the wilderness and everybody pitching in and grunting and sweating mightily till it's all done. If our pioneer fathers had divided the first settlements and gathered in separate camps and built stockades separately with guns pointing at each other, the wilderness would have gone back to the wolves. But our pioneer fathers, for all their individualistic land, greed, mutual suspicions, political and religious differences, got along together somehow because they shared common enemies, the savages and the elements, the wilderness itself, which they'd ridden out to battle and to beat. Because they acknowledged common enemies, the United Nations got along together during the war. No such enemies are shared today. No enemies are recognized, but they exist. They aren't shooting enemies, but they're entirely fatal. Are you a Hindu or a Muslim or a subscriber to the Chicago Tribune? Whatever you are, the enemy is no single nation in the United Nations, because no one of those nations or any grouping of them wants war. The enemies are not to be found in particular force on any side of any national boundary. The enemies are everywhere, behind every line. They are the enemies of progress, the professional wreckers of peace. They are involved in the best organized of all conspiracies, the old international plot against the people. Besides the experts, these are the simple, there are the simple aspects of defeat. Not people at all, the things. They've been called the forces of darkness, hunger and hate, greed and sickness and fear. These are enemies shared by all the United Nations. They can only be overcome by all the United Nations working together like the pioneers they are or ought to be in this new fight against the wilderness. A tough policy or a soft policy are both admissions of war as the end of the argument. We cannot found an enduring peace by appeasement or by bullying. Unless the powers occupy their restless energies and sublimate their respective suspicions in a total global offensive as thorough as a shooting war against what makes a shooting war, we'll have a shooting war. The ultimate enemy of peace in our time or any time is no one nation or alliance of nations. The ultimate enemy of peace is the very principle of nations. The problem is not what to do about the Russians. The problem is what to do about the perverse survival in this brave new age of the atom of competitive nationalism, a luxury or rather an old-fashioned bad habit this shrinking globe of ours no longer has the room or leisure to support. That's what I'm going to Providence to say in effect in taking Mr. Wallace's place, and I hope that he'll say at the end of the trip that I get to keep his cane. Now my time is up for this Sunday. Thanks for coming to call. Till next Sunday, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Next week, those of you who live in communities now observing daylight saving time will once again return to standard time. But this station will continue to bring you Orson Welles at the same time you heard him today. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.